one of the challenges of being an aging professor is that these fresh new people come along, win all the popularity contests, and, well, it's just a challenge. And the next person I want to introduce is one of those. He has been teaching now. He's in his second year teaching at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. His course is enormously popular and fought after. Students come begging to get into it, and it's an extremely important addition to our curriculum. That man is Ken Dryden, known to most of you as a legendary hockey player, a well-known figure in Canadian political life, an author. Some of his books are outside. And we're very, very pleased not only to have him with us in the Institute teaching, but to have him here to introduce a very special presentation. So I ask you to join me in welcoming Ken Dryden.
Thank you. Thanks, Will. And thank you for the invitation to be here. I was able to be here most of yesterday, and your sessions are really stimulating, really interesting. And I want to thank Will also for allowing me to have two new experiences. One is the chance to teach here at the Institute, and the other is today to have the chance to be an introducer. Thank you. The course that I teach is called Making the Future. And the essential approach of it is understanding that students are so focused on and so obsessed by imagining what their own futures are, and for the most part, in the courses they take, they learn about the past, and they learn about the present, and they learn about how things got to be the way they are. But of course, for the next 40 plus years, they will be in the workplace. For the next 60 plus years, they will be living their lives. And the question is, what lives? What workplace? What do they want to do? They are old enough now to start to have some idea of what they like, what they don't like, what they might want to do, what they don't want to do, how they see themselves, how they see their country, how they see the world, and to try to get into that kind of conversation. And one of the things that in the midst of doing the course last year, I got an invitation to do an event in Peterborough. And I said I would, but only on the condition that they created a community event on this particular subject. And the subject is head injuries and concussions. And to me, as I look at many sports, and certainly hockey and football are among them, that if you look at those things that will most define the future, it is how we deal with this question. And that, as I say to people, that all of us, when we look back at things that were 50 years ago or 100 years ago, at a time when there was slavery, at a time when there were few women's rights, at a time when tobacco smoking was as prevalent as it was, we look at back at people at that time and we say, you know, how could they be so stupid? How could they not have known? How could they have missed it so badly? But knowing, of course, that 50 years from now, people will be looking back at us and saying exactly the same thing about us, about something. And the key for any of us, whether it's at a university or in politics or in our own lives, is to try to imagine what those big ones are. What are those things that we are getting really wrong now that will have enormous implications on the future? So we had this, created this conference in Peterborough, and it was really interesting. I mean, you know, we decided this was an approach to take, not knowing whether it was going to work. In fact, it worked fairly well. So I told the class about it, the class here at McGill, and a student came forward at the end of the year, and I'll just say one other thing before this student, before I get to that part, is that on the first day of class, she came up to me and she said, we've met before, and which is always an awkward moment, and knowing that I had no idea where we had met, and she said, well, actually, we had met in my hometown of Dryden, Ontario. And you were there for the 100th anniversary, and I remembered all of that, and yes, and still it wasn't ringing a bell that we had met. And she said, well, actually, you might not have recognized me. And okay. And she said, well, my dad owns the local A&W, and sometimes I make appearances as the A&W root bear. And that's how I met you. So then, at the end of, after we had done the Peterborough event, and I had mentioned it in class, at the end of the year, Sarah came up to me and said, would you mind if I tried to create that same kind of community event in Dryden, Ontario, this summer? And I said, no, absolutely not. I knew Sarah a little bit by this time, and I knew that she wouldn't give up on it easily, but I was certainly imagining that if she didn't give up through May and June, that she might give up in early July, and that this event wouldn't happen. But I would get emails, and this was going. Well, in the end, we had this event in Dryden, Ontario, population under 8,000. About 100 people were there, and it was exactly the kind of gathering that this question needs. It was those who have had experiences with concussions telling their story. Not just I got elbowed when I went into the corner, but what it felt like, what it was like the day after, what it meant that they could do in terms of school, the effect on with their friends, whatever it was, telling their story. Then it was doctors telling their experience in dealing with people with concussions. Then it was the local hockey people. What is it that they can do? And Sarah put all of this together. So, you know, when I arrived in mid-August to do it, it was all there and set out, and we did it. And it was important to have done it. And as I think back on it now, and I was thinking about it last night, we've got, after the Peterborough one, I had done one in Regina, this one in Dryden. Next week, I have one in Guelph. There's a big one in Calgary at the end of April. But no matter how many of these we do, I'm sure that I will look back and think that there were two that really mattered in terms of it all. And one was in Peterborough, because that's where we started it and set out the template, and the other was in Dryden, Ontario. Because if you can do it in Dryden, Ontario, a population under 8,000, you can do it anywhere in the country. And that's the real test of any model, is not whether you can make it work in exceptional, positive circumstances, in easy circumstances, but whether you can make it in unexceptional circumstances and find a way of making it work. So I'm very pleased to be the introducer today of Sarah Larniuk. Sarah, come on up and tell your story.
Good afternoon. I would like to begin by saying what an honor it is to be here to share my experience with you all. My name is Sarah Larniuk, and I'm a fourth-year undergrad student in political science and economics here at McGill. So it's somewhat daunting to be up here with all these remarkable people. I'm just a student. I've only worked in fast food. As a student, I don't have a lot of time for reading outside of classes, but yesterday I picked up the book Home Game in the Lobby by Ken Dryden and Roy McGregor. I thought a paragraph from the introduction would give a good background to what I'll be talking about and why it's so important to taking off and flying high in Canada. Hockey is part sport and recreation, part entertainment, part business, part community builder, social connector, and fantasy maker. It is played in every province and territory, and in every part of every province and territory in this country. Once a game for little boys, now little girls play as well, and so do older men and women. So do the blind and the mentally and physically handicapped. And though its symmetry is far from perfect, hockey does far better than most at cutting through social division. Young and old, rich and poor, urban and rural, French and English, East and West, able and disabled. It is this breadth, its reach into the past that makes hockey such a vivid instrument through which to view Canadian life. Last winter, I was fortunate enough to meet Mr. Dryden and have him as my professor for Canadian Studies class on the future of Canada. It was because of that opportunity that I later had the chance to bring a conference on head injuries in hockey to my hometown of Dryden, Ontario. I was motivated to organize this conference for a number of reasons. First, I was captivated by the passion Mr. Dryden had for this project. In the past few years, he has made it his goal to make a difference in hockey, to make it safer for everyone to play, and to see a meeting of the top officials, including Gary Bettman and Don Lafleur. If his track record offers any indication, I know he'll succeed. Second, Dryden, Ontario, like many rural Canadian communities, is a town that simply revolves around hockey. If you aren't a player, you're sitting in the arena for hours on end watching hockey. I was a member of the latter group, but my brother, 8 years my junior, does play hockey, which was my third reason for caring so much about this conference. It finally mattered to me personally what was happening on the other side of the boards. My brother, Peter, is a pretty gangly kid. He's taller than me, but weighs less than 100 pounds. So he's smaller than a lot of the boys in his division, and it makes it really easy to worry about him out there. This conference was important to my community, not just for the safety of the kids while they're on the ice, but for the safety of their futures. Playing hockey should not mean having to choose between sport and brain damage. The discussion on head injuries in hockey is one that doesn't just matter today. It will continue to have lasting consequences as long as the problem is ignored. The decisions made by our hockey organizations will affect hockey players for years to come. With all of this in mind, in April I asked Mr. Dryden if he would be willing to come and speak on the risks of head injuries in hockey in my hometown, which is coincidentally also a hometown to Chris Pronger, a defenseman for the Philadelphia Flyers who hasn't played since November 19, 2011 due to severe post-concussion symptoms. Thankfully, Mr. Dryden agreed, and 4 months and a lot of planning later, Dryden, Ontario had the Honorable Ken Dryden, hockey legend, en route for a symposium on head injuries in hockey. The symposium was made up of three sections. First, we had teenagers from our community come forward with stories of the concussions they had experienced. And second, we had local doctors offer their insight into the problem at hand. And third, we had a number of respected members of our hockey community, including coaches, referees, and a representative from Hockey Canada. The presentation was concluded with a discussion period where the audience was free to ask their questions and give their input. Roughly 100 people showed up to listen to the panelists I had assembled. Not a bad showing for a hot Saturday afternoon in Dryden, especially since an hour away, Mike Richards had the Stanley Cup on display that same afternoon. While there was many knowledgeable hockey personalities from the region on the panel, it was the three teens that stole the show. The players, all between ages 15 and 19, talked about the frustrations having dealt with concussions, the agony of being stuck on the bench while they watched their teammates play on for weeks and for months. One of the kids admitted that he had been unable to leave his darkened bedroom for a week, while his father testified to the helplessness he had felt at the situation. Another boy confessed to indefinitely putting off applying for college because he was simply unable to learn or to concentrate the way he used to prior to sustaining his concussions. This was not the first concussion for any of these kids, and the reality finally hit me of how serious this situation was. The day-to-day lives of these kids had changed. Their attitude, their ability to concentrate, even just hanging out with their friends became an insurmountable task for them in the weeks following these concussions. For one of them, likely having suffered permanent brain damage from repeated head injury, has ultimately changed the course of his life, making college seem like an inconceivable milestone in his future. The audience was stunned by the stories of the local teens, and the stories were hitting a little too close to home for many of the parents. Due to the lack of treatment that exists for concussions and head injuries, prevention becomes an important aspect of the discussion. However, we also talked in great length about the precautions that must be taken post-concussion. In the months since the seminar, Dryden's Minor Hockey Association has taken a number of steps to try and ameliorate the situation. Officials have become more stringent in enforcing headshot regulations. And this season, they implemented mandatory forms that must be signed by a physician to ensure the proper return to play protocol is followed before they are allowed to return to the ice. These forms, drawn up by a physician from Atikokan, Ontario, are now being reviewed for regional use by Hockey Northwestern Ontario. Nearly full attendance of Dryden's medical doctors helped to fast-track this process. Having everyone on the same page is incredibly helpful. All of this is fantastic progress, and a solution can't be found overnight, but the fact is it just isn't enough. However, the beauty of the symposium wasn't to find a solution that afternoon or even this hockey season. The fact is that it sparked much-needed discussion. The symposium succeeded in bringing together the hockey community on a subject that had the scope of affecting every person in our town, allowing them to find that they all wanted to make the sport they loved safe for the children, and together, change was possible. This was something that had never happened before, and I had the honor of setting it in motion with the help of Mr. Dryden. In the sources discussing the program, in the weeks and the months following the symposium, I continued to receive emails from various sources discussing new programs, coaching clinics, and so on that were being implemented in Dryden and the region of Northwestern Ontario, which is at least a step in the right direction. The overwhelming conclusion that we reached during the discussion period from our seminar is that young hockey players are often being raised today thinking that hockey is number one. The goal is the NHL or bust. The need to succeed is overwhelming their judgment, and so, even when concussed, many players will do anything to get back into the game, especially if it happens during crucial times like playoffs. Safety nets can be put in place to try and prevent these players from returning to play before they're ready, but the truth of the matter is that it's not a foolproof system, and no one can stop these players from stepping back onto the ice if they have their heart set on it. What else became obvious was that these kids aren't the only ones that think they're going to the NHL. In a lot of cases, there is a strong pressure from the parents, and if the parents aren't going to take the initiative to stop their own children from stepping out onto the ice too soon after a concussion, risking permanent brain damage, then whose responsibility is it? What became clear through the seminar is that our attitudes need to change. Maybe hockey isn't everything. Hitting was developed as a way to create puck turnover, not to injure your opponents. While this is not a problem specific to Canada, Canada does have the largest number of ice hockey players in the world. According to the International Ice Hockey Federation, Canada is home to more than 572,000 players, versus the runner-up, the United States, with just over 500,000 players. If Canadian hockey associations were to set new standards for their players, could hardly be ignored by the international associations. It's no longer merely about protecting the elite players of the NHL, but about protecting the kids. Canada has more than 468,000 hockey players registered under the age of 20. How can we expect them to excel in hockey, much less in any other areas of their lives, if they've sustained brain damage due to our complacency? Thank you.
Thank you for that fascinating presentation, Sarah, and to Mr. Dryden for the introduction. It now gives me great pleasure to turn over the stage to our sports and athletics panel, moderated by CBC Radio 1's In a Weekend host, Sonali Karnick.
Thank you, Will, and welcome, everyone. This is going to be a very interesting panel discussion, I'm sure, as we are going to touch on many different levels of sport. First, I'd like to introduce our panel and bring them up to the stage. It gives me great pleasure to announce our members. Mr. Richard Pound. Mr. Pound is the founding president of the World Anti-Doping Agency and former vice president of the International Olympic Committee. Mr. Pound is also a former Olympic swimmer and currently practices law at the firm Steichman Elliott. Mr. Pound, welcome. Mr. Ross Rebiati is a professional snowboarder and is the first ever snowboarder to win gold in the Olympics at Nagano in 1998. Ross Rebiati. And Madame Danielle Sauvageau is the former head coach, rather, of the Canadian national women's hockey team and led the team to gold at the 2002 Winter Olympics. She is also a 27-year veteran of the RCMP. And finally, Ms. Madeline Williams is a former Olympian who competed in cross-country skiing at the 2010 Winter Olympics, anchoring the 4x5K relay at the Vancouver Olympics. She's also a McGill Law student with research focus on gender equity in elite sport. Each of our panelists will now talk about their definition of success. They have a short presentation to make. And then we have some questions that our panelists will answer, and we will open the floor to you as well to ask some questions. So first, let's hear from Mr. Richard Pound.
Over there?
You can actually stay seated if you'd like, but that's up to you.
No, I'm up.
Okay.
Well, thank you, and good morning, everyone. We decided with our panel that we would first start off with a couple of minutes each on defining success, or at least the elements of success in sport. And I want you to understand it's north of half a century since I had any appreciable success on a field of play, so my view is somewhat longer. But let me speak about a few things. Success is the setting of ambitious and incremental goals and figuring out how to achieve them. In many respects, success depends on overcoming the fear of being unsuccessful. And thirdly, as a general proposition, hope is not a plan. In competitive sport, you have the opportunity to decide where you want to be on the matrix of success, whether it's local competition, provincial, national, or international, and you set your goals and your plans accordingly. In competitive sport, success is generally measured by winning without cheating. Organizational success is helping to make a positive difference on the part of the organization, and I've had some experience in changing the paradigms in the International Olympic Committee and creating new ones in the World Anti-Doping Agency. Success, I think, is a result rather than a goal. Success, it depends, there's an internal component to it, on knowing whether or not you have done your very best. And that's, frankly, something that only you know. Nobody else can know that. And finally, as a wrap, success is never final.
Thank you, Mr. Pound. I'd like to invite Ross Rebiati up now.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity. That's what I was going to say. Actually, there's a lot of similarities in what I'm about to say and what Richard said as well. I did jot down a couple of things that I thought, you know, made sense to me. One thing is knowing who you are as a person and having that ability creates an easier venue for you to appreciate your success. If you're not comfortable with who you are and where you've come from and where you think you're going, it makes it that much harder to actually appreciate and to recognize the goals that you've set forth for yourself and the ability to accomplish them. Another thing I thought was interesting was that failure is always an option. And you have to also make a decision to succeed. I know that winning in my case is a losing game. So in order, basically that means like if you want to win, then then you have to experience losing, you know, many, many times. So one victory can, you know, be the accumulation of, you know, dozens of losses, you know, in your mind. Although those losses are parts of small goals, like Richard mentioned, that add up to a big goal. So another thing is, let's see. Yeah, so I mean, for me in particular, I had a lot of things against me when I got into snowboarding. I was a ski racer up until 1987. And when I started snowboarding that same year, there was no ski resorts in Canada that allowed snowboarding. And as you can imagine, my father was very excited about my ski racing and how well I was doing and that I was training with the, you know, the next level up, the older boys. And for me to stop that and to take up a sport that you weren't even allowed to do was sort of my first, I guess, foray into, you know, adversity and dealing with, you know, how my father felt about that. I think that, you know, as snowboarding progressed and as it got more and more popular, and it did in a hurry, actually, because it was only 10 years after I started that I found myself competing at the Olympics. And, you know, it was a great experience to have had the opportunity to bring a sport from its conception all the way, you know, to the top of professional sports or in the Olympics amateur sports. But, you know, and then I had some more adversity at the Olympics that I think everybody can probably remember when I tested positive for marijuana. And that was also something that I had to overcome and accept. And, it, you know, it wasn't easy, and I did get a lot of notoriety, you know, because of that. But it's all a matter of, you know, playing the hand that you're dealt and realizing, like in my case, that I had a philosophy of, you know, it's better to, you know, have no time than a slow time. And so I just, you know, forged ahead. And I think that's my time. But in a nutshell, I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
And now I'd like to invite Danielle Sauvageau.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I had the privilege to coach and to mentor a coach. I never had the privilege to play. I never played hockey or barely not. I grew up in a city where there was no rink. And I remember my grandmother actually used to say to us when we were a kid, success is about going back to where you're from and finding friends and finding people who had been supporting you to continue to do what you always loved. And along the way, I always find people who didn't want me to play hockey or to coach hockey or to mentor hockey. But at the same time, I think she was right. It's by going back to on your path and to see people who has been ready, who has been ready to help you and to still be there actually to support you. I read a lot about also Bernard Shaw, and he used to say that there's people looking at a situation and say, why? And there's other people who's looking at the same situation and say, why not? And for me, the why not always been sort of my motto. Why not coaching hockey? Why not pursuing women's sport? Why not mentoring other sports that I never even played or look at? For the 2010 Olympics, I was working with 14 coaches in the preparation to the Olympics because I had the firm belief that sport in this country bring this country together in a way that nothing else had brought this country before together the way it did for 2010. And obviously, when we look at that, when there was a time that the rest of the world didn't think that we were able to put a sport system the way that we did, we believed in it. And I think success is, yes, option. Failure is always an option, but, and like Mr. Pound said, success never ends because there's always somewhere, something, somehow to be done by someone. And I think that this is what it's great about this country, is that we find way, even if sometimes we don't have the tools to do it. Thank you.
Uh, And last but certainly not least, Madeline Williams.
So thank you so much for this opportunity. Like Ross, I have defined myself as an athlete for most of my life. I grew up in a normal middle-class family in Edmonton, but I started skiing as soon as I could walk, and I started racing when I was 11. By 14, I devoted my life to one day representing Canada at the Olympics. I achieved this goal that was my singular focus for so long in 2010 at the Vancouver Olympics. I retired from elite sport following the Vancouver Games, and I'm now in my second year of law school here at McGill. When I qualified for the Olympics, I thought I understood what success was. My definition at that time was one of achievement and accomplishment. By achieving this life goal, I felt I had succeeded. But with a couple of years of perspective and a little more experience with real life, I now define success as being at peace with myself, earning the respect of my peers, and inspiring the next generation to surpass what I've achieved. Success is really more of a lifelong journey than a single major achievement. The beautiful thing, though, is that representing Canada at the Olympics did help me to fulfill these necessary components of success. Achieving this major life goal definitely brought me peace. Of course, I'm striving for more, and I have big ambitions for my future career in law. And being an Olympian has also gone a long way towards earning me the respect of my peers. Most importantly, though, it has given me the opportunity to inspire the next generation of women to reach for their dreams. I'm using the law school context to work with some great legal minds like Professor Hoi Kong to make sport policy change recommendations to bring gender equity into our elite sports system, bring it up to the high standard that we expect in Canadian society. I'm also involved with Fast and Female, which is an organization that encourages girls to stay in sport by inspiring them through events that put them in contact with top-level athletes. Seeing the fire in these girls' eyes when they start to understand how many opportunities are available to them and how far they can take their dreams makes every sacrifice I've ever made worth it, and that's when I know I'm successful.
Thank you, panelists, for your thoughts. We have a few topics to get to when it comes to success in sports in Canada, and I'll allow our panelists to answer, but feel free to come up to the microphones and ask a question yourself. The first one, with the Sochi Games 1 year away, Canada's Own the Podium program will be a very big topic of discussion as Canada strives for an even higher medal count for the next Winter Olympics. Own the Podium is a funding program that gives money to the many aspects of competitive sport, coaching to medical support to help sports with the greatest medal potential. So we are asking, what is the relationship between funding and success in sports in Canada? And actually, Madeline, I don't know if you would like to start that with your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, I think obviously you need funding in order to have opportunities to learn to succeed. Something like Own the Podium is good in the short term. The elements it funds are required to take the final step from competing internationally to winning medals internationally. That final little bit with the sports science, the access to opportunities that it allows is really important there. But these types of fine-tuning things don't really impact the development stages. And in the end, it could be detrimental on development to focus so highly on medals, which, we'll see in a few years down the road what impact it has been to turn our focus from one of getting participation at the base to focusing entirely on medals.
All right, any of our other panels?
I believe that what Podium brought, it's not only funding, but it's the way that we've been working with sport as well. Integrated support expertise brought this country to the next level. Having the coaches working and having the privilege to work with the best physiologists, mental coach, biomechanics, help the athlete actually to make sure that there's nothing that has not been looked at. And for sure, it's creating peace, knowing that you go to the Olympics and everything was done in order to support you to perform. And that's the true actor of the games, are obviously the athlete. But I often say that If the athletes are the heart of the game, the coaches are the heart of the athletes. And this is where we believe that we need to continue to provide our coaches in this country the best resources to go to the next level. And of course, I'm a coach, so I'm going to say that this is where we need to continue to improve. But I'm with you, in order to sustain those results that we've been having over the years, we need to continue to invest in our development athletes through CIS, through university, but podium, because of some resources lacking, obviously are not looking at that level as well.
I think the Own the Podium program is indispensable. The support that the athletes need is much greater than what most would probably expect. I think that the psychological benefit from having the support of your country, but also the coaches and being able to travel around the world. I know from my own experience that, you know, right away in the beginning of the year, I had to drop 10 grand on airplane tickets, like in a lump sum. And that was before funding existed in snowboarding. And so I can say for sure that not having the pressures of where is the money going to come from, how am I going to cover my rent back home, and am I going to be able to afford to have a normal family and to move forward in my life after sport, I think takes a lot of pressure and enables the athlete to actually focus. I think today, especially with the economic state of affairs, it's pretty hard to ignore the obvious, and that's what are you going to do when you're finished sports, what are you going to do afterwards, and from my own experience, I didn't give that much thought. And I think that to have the infrastructure there for people who are, I was young, and for people who are older to understand that, yeah, this athlete is just focused right now on competing at a high level, but we have to make sure that they're ready and that they're aware of the future that is coming.
I think adequate funding, but not excessive funding, is important. As far as I'm concerned, the real crucible in which great sport performances are born, it comes in the relationship between the coach and the athlete. So anything you can do to make sure that our coaches know everything possible about their sport, that's great. That's where you get your medals, not from the meter-high plan that's developed at Sport Canada. That said, how you use the available loaves and fishes is pretty important. And the Own the Podium had a number of advantages. One is that it brought the private sector and the public sector money together. And then it was allocated on the basis of performance or demonstrated indications of high performance. And so you had people who know sports saying, yes, you have a good program here, we will fund it to the hilt. And on the other hand, you don't have a good program here, you have no possibility of medal performance, we're not going to waste any of our money on that. Very difficult if it's Sport Canada and government stuff where you say, well, if we give something to Victoria, we've got to give something to Prince Edward Island, and you get a whole bunch of lowest common denominator funding decisions. So Own the Podium was good, and it was additionally good because it focused coaches' attention, athletes' attention, the public's attention on owning the podium, a very un-Canadian approach to things. In fact, you know, there's a lot of criticism about this. This isn't really Canadian. I mean, we're there for a good time and to be nice folks, but to win. Anyway, the result is we won in Vancouver with a fairly short window, won more gold medals than any other country in the history of the Winter Games. The proof of the pudding is going to be next year to see whether we can maintain that momentum.
But let me ask you all this. Given the result of the 2010 Winter Games, we often look to the U.S. for funding athletics, for a model to funding athletics. In terms of the private sector, how far does the private sector in Canada have to go to get there? Because Own the Podium is a public and privately funded entity. So how far does the public sector have to come to get to that same level so that athletes can have that same level of funding?
Well, it's kind of a joint decision. You have to decide at the government level whether this is good for the country as a whole on a variety of levels. Commercially, if you're going to the private sector or the business sector, they have a fiduciary duty to invest their shareholders' money in something that will be good for the business. And basically the combination of the Olympics and business has proven to be pretty good. It's quite different in the United States, where the high-performance delivery model is the university system. Quite different from what it is in Canada.
I think we were talking about that, Danielle and Madeline are talking about the how Canada's university model has to change to be able to support athletes better, amateur athletes better, to moving on to the next level.
Well, change in a way that we also need to work together, like with the federal association, provincial association, but to make sure that it's a path that our athlete could take. In the United States, they go through colleges and university, and it's part of the Olympic almost process. As here, for in women's hockey, actually, we lose our best talent to the States, and that is, for me, unacceptable. We lose also other athletes. There's some sport that does not exist at the university level, but we need to use this university level while they go to school, and then there will be an after sport, especially for female hockey, and in hockey they don't have the NHL, for example. But then to use that path to say, hey, this is a pride, this is us, Canada, and how could we work together and allow our athlete to go to university, go from their team to the national team and back. Because right now they go to the States, when they come back to us, they're burned out. Because the only thing that university wants to do in the United States, and it's mostly in every sport or just about, is to win. And then when they come back to us, they don't want to do sports anymore. So we need to work together.
Absolutely agree. I mean, it's almost there's an opportunity here with the CIS and Canadian University Sport to really work with the national sport organizations to make the most of the opportunities that are available in the infrastructure and the funding that's already in place in Canada. I think there's a lot of opportunities for developing athletes from sort of the national level to the elite international level in those years between high school and your mid-20s, when you're just, as Ross and I were discussing yesterday, that you're hitting your peak as an athlete in your mid-20s at the earliest for most of us. And you need a gap fill there, an opportunity to get an education and make a future for yourself after skiing, or after sport in general, for me it was skiing. And I think university sport, if it was played well with the national sport organizations, could really fill that role.
Do you feel as if the talent in your sport, for example, in Canada, is going to the U.S. like a lot of women's hockey players?
No, actually, most of the top talent in my sport chooses to not go to university at all. Which I feel is quite sad.
Because they're competing in
exactly.
With club teams?
Because, by the time you graduate from high school, if you're already traveling, for the majority of the winter school, it just isn't feasible.
And just to give you an example, by the way, of how aggressive a lot of American recruiters are, Catherine Ward, of course, plays for the McGill Martlets. When she was deciding on which university to go to, there were 4 U.S. Ivy League schools offering her scholarships to go play hockey there. And she chose to come to McGill to play for the McGill Martlets. And she's not the only one. There are many who are going through that. Why don't we get to gender equity? Because I think that it has a lot to do with funding and a lot to do with success in sports. And for men and women, team athletes and individual sport athletes, of course, have different experiences when it comes to funding and opportunities. For example, women competing in individual sports sometimes have parity over their male counterparts, while female team athletes might have a different perspective at different levels of competition. So how successful is Canada when it comes to gender equality in sports? I know that's a very big question, so if you have any questions, please come up to the mic and ask them yourselves to our panel. But how does Canada rank in terms of gender equity with funding or opportunities for sports?
I actually did a whole bunch of research on this fall, and just wrote a paper on this very topic, and I think Canada does very well. But of course, we can always do better. I think our standard as a society for what gender equity means for Canadians is quite high, and I don't think elite sport anyway quite measures up just yet. I've in my travels for this paper, I came up with what I feel is a good substantive definition that we should strive for in Canada for what gender equity should look like in Canada. And to me, this is equal opportunities to advance to the elite level, which comes down to proportionality between the number of athletes competing at the national level and the number of elite opportunities, senior karting, Olympics, World Cup opportunities available to those athletes. So that, I mean, maybe it's not formal equality, but Canada has never defined gender equity as formal equality. It's more than that. It's equity. Do you have the same opportunity? Can you see these opportunities ahead of you? And that, you know, that will inspire you to stay the course.
Danielle, how do you experience that with hockey?
Very interesting question, actually. If I go back, for example, in 2002, when I decided to step down as a head coach of the women's team, I knock at two NHL door, actually, to say, well, my two assistant coach were men and they are in the NHL, so why not me? And they basically told me that they were not ready for that. And I will not name the team, but it's actually a three Canadian team. But it's for sure it's not the same thing in hockey, and I could understand a lot of the reason for that. When you want to win, you're always going to trust a little bit more people that you know, and people who have been demonstrated like the ability to be there. And obviously, the NHL never been open to women. I had the privilege to work with the Montreal Rockets for a year, which is the junior major league in Canada. It's the first time that a woman was coaching at that level, and so far, it's the last time, and I believe that one day we'll see a woman coaching in the NHL. Maybe the first entry will be as a mental prep coach or technical coach or something like that, but then again, it's the same thing that when I first started. I basically asked if I could play. They say, no, but you can bring the water bottle to the bench, and maybe that's the bench word that I remember, and then obviously I became a coach. But then again, I look at other sports, and just for the 2012 Olympics, for example, United States has more, by far, more women winning gold and medal than the men. Great Britain, the same thing, and China, the same thing. So I believe that the country who wants to win medal will have to invest in women's sport. But the next level now is to put women in position of leadership in order to open those paths and to look at sport as human being. Period. But for that, I think that we need to find a way to bring women in a position of leadership. And Canada so far has been doing a great job for that, actually.
sorry. It's okay. For me in particular, with snowboarding, gender equality, I think, is pretty equal. The men and the women travel together. It's not a men's tour and a women's tour. We travel together. A lot of times, even though they're competing at a different time during the day, as a group, we share the same coaches as the men's teams. And also within our industry, we have other opportunities that other sports don't offer, as far as fashion, for example, is concerned. I think snowboard attire and what you look like is much different for the guys than it is for the girls. And the girls have an opportunity to promote, like some companies like Roxy, for example, that make really nice snowboard outfits that aren't so baggy like the guys, and are a little bit more form-fitting, and you can see the athlete a little bit more in the female light of things. And I think this month Snowboard Canada has an all-women's snowboard magazine devoted completely to the female athletes. And so, I mean, for us, it's always been that way. We've never had, like the ski tour, for example, where it's the men's downhill 1 week, and then the next week in another country is the women's downhill. And so, yeah, just from my perspective, like, the opportunities are generally equal. And the other thing, too, with funding is that I think that gets lost a little bit are the professional opportunities that come about. I know that when snowboarding became part of the national team system and was accepted into the Olympics, then we had to conform also to the national team sponsors and had to give up our own sponsors. And for me in particular, being at the top of my sport, before I came into the Olympics, I had to give up lucrative contracts to be able to go and realize my ski racing dream to compete at the Olympics. And I think it would be important maybe to consider the idea that maybe within the venue, okay, we have to promote the national team sponsors, but to also allow the athletes, if they're able, to endorse non-national team sponsors or opportunities.
I think that on the field of play, the issue of gender equity is really not that serious. I think the women are funded comparably to the men, and in fact they perform on average better in high performance sport. The Olympic program is getting closer and closer to being 50-50, so those opportunities will continue to arise. As Danielle says, the real issue is what do you do after you've stopped competing? I think Canada's been pretty good at that. We're not, nobody's perfect, but I mean, we've had a female president of the Canadian Olympic Committee. We've had several female chefs de mission of our teams and assistant chefs. The two athlete members that we've elected under the new athlete member system have both, the athletes put forward have both been female. The second IOC member in Canada, when we had individual memberships, was female. So we've done pretty well, but it's a long slog in getting to the top of these international or national even and international organizations. And there are impediments, not from the system so much as just no matter how thin you slice it, the women have the children. And those priorities change when you get to that point.
But does there have to be something within the system to help that, to make women feel more comfortable going into those roles, knowing that they can have the time and can dedicate themselves comfortably?
Oh, no, I think if you have the time and the commitment, there are no glass ceilings in that respect. We got our share of Neanderthals, of course, but... It's that's changing somewhat, and there's increasing evidence that the world will not end if a woman gets to the top.
I think it's a bit of a dangerous argument that you actually hear a lot in employment equity contexts as well. That you know it's not the employer who's at fault. It's the personal choices that a woman's made. But it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. You know, are these choices that they look like choices a woman's making, are they in fact reflections of the opportunities available to her? Or are they actually choices that she's making? I think it's not an easy distinction to make. And further on that note, it does depend a fair bit on the sport. Like in skiing, I know our national team is about twice as many men as women, and I definitely, a big reason for my retirement was that I didn't see the opportunities available to me. So I think it does depend on the sport, and Canada is doing quite well in the international perspective, but there's definitely still some ground to be made here.
Well, let's move on to our next topic, which actually has to do with success starting out. Many athletes have to train outside of Canada for both summer and winter sports. It's costly and time-consuming, but it is a practice that is very widespread to improve the level of competition of Canadian athletes. What do we need to do to improve the infrastructure for athletes within Canada so that we can be successful? And I know, Ross, you've mentioned that you've had to travel quite a lot to, I mean, especially in the beginning for snowboarding, and maybe the infrastructure wasn't there in Canada to get to that level of competition.
I think inevitably the athlete has to go where the competition is. And in hockey, it's here. So you can stay home. For ski racing and for alpine snowboard racing and a lot of sports, the competition with regard to winter in particular is in Europe. And, I knew as an aspiring ski racer that one of my dreams was to go to Austria because that's where all the best ski racers were from. And I know there's a lot of other countries out there that produce top level. But when I gave up the dream to, you know, be a ski racer, to become a snowboarder, then I was just longing for that dream to continue on. And when I finally did actually move to Europe, I spent almost 10 years living there and racing against the best guys in the world. That's when my level really came up. My first race on the World Cup Tour, I was 80th place out of, like, you know, 100 guys from all over the world. And it was hard because I was used to winning here in Canada, thinking that, okay, you know, Canada can't be that far behind. And as it turned out, and I don't mean this as a gender issue or anything like that, but half the women beat me also at that race. And it just motivated me to realize that what I was doing was the right thing to do, that if I was actually going to follow my dream to be at the highest level in the world, then I had to actually live and compete and breathe and drink the same water as the highest level athletes in the world, and so that's what I did.
But why can't we do that here?
Well, you can do that here. Like I said, with hockey, we do breed the highest level in the world, and I think athletes from around the world in hockey come to Canada to learn the game the way we play it. And I'm not an expert at all in hockey, but just from a fan's perspective, I know for a fact that there's only so many places on Earth that can produce hockey players like we can with the population that we have and the infrastructure financially that we have. And, you know, for me, it was just a realization, it was just reality, it was just what I had to do, and luckily it was what I wanted to do.
Madeline, is it the same case for you that you did have to go abroad to become more competitive and realistic?
Very much so. I mean, the competitions, as Ross mentioned, for skiing are mostly in Europe. That's where most of the competitors are. That's where the paying and television audiences are, especially for cross-country skiing. It's not on TV here. It is on TV in Europe. There are big sports fans there who pay money to come watch the races, which isn't the case here. So just from a purely business model perspective, you can see why the vast majority of the races are there. And nothing that Canada does infrastructure-wise is going to change that. That's a sport culture thing. Here we do, for cross-country skiing, we do a good job of having on-snow opportunities, training center opportunities in Canada for our developing athletes. I mean, the nature of the beast is we have to centralize here because we have such a big country, and that can be good and bad for you know, schooling opportunities or for some people who prefer to stay at home. I think in general, the infrastructure in Canada is there. It's more the reason for having to go overseas, for me anyway, was a competition thing. It wasn't a training, lack of training opportunities here.
Okay. And we have a question from the audience.
Hi. I just want to know, how do you get to the elite level? Like, what do you have to do to get in those competitions, you know, go to Austria, like, or Austin, or just go everywhere, you know, like, start off your, not, well, I guess career, but, you know, just starting off, like, this, like, what you want to do, like, I've snowboarded as well, and, like, this really, like, my passion is what I like to do, but I just want to know, like, how would you get to the elite levels, like, I mean, all of you have experience in it, and, yeah.
I guess I'll handle this one. First of all, you have to have the will and the drive to want to do it in the first place, and to realize that there's going to be things that you're going to have to sacrifice in order to do that, friends and family, for example. I think at your level, your first step would be to find out where the competitions are, which disciplines you're most interested in, which ones you excel in the most. And for me in particular, snowboarding had a big freestyle component to it, and I actually did compete in World Cup in halfpipe as well before I focused just on racing. And I realized that in a judged event, sometimes you have to have a big name to get the big points, like Sean White or something like that. But in racing, you just had to beat the clock. And it didn't matter where you came from or what your name is or anything like that. As long as you were, you know, winning, beating the clock, then, you know, you could win the race. But so I think identifying those things, like figuring it out exactly, and it doesn't happen right away. Like, you might get into border cross or half pipe and then realize that you want to, you know, go into alpine completely and race, or just do the half pipe or just do the border cross. And so it'll take time. You can enter in all those disciplines. But then commit yourself to the tour I mean, for me, it was different because I was in high school when I started competing, and there was no infrastructure for me to go to the competitions and still stay in school. So I was actually missing Fridays and Mondays, to the point where my principal called in my dad, and he's like, you know, how come Ross is missing all this school? And so we explained what was going on, and that there was no infrastructure in high school for me to continue doing that. And basically, it was an ultimatum that I was either going to not go to school anymore and compete, or be allowed just to go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and compete. And luckily for me, the principal of the school allowed me to miss Mondays and Fridays. Now, even in the springtime when I wasn't competing, I still missed Fridays and Mondays. But I think if you can identify that sort of thing and then commit yourself and express that to your family and speak with your principal, maybe, you know, at school and say, this is what I want to do. Is there some way that you can allow me to do this? Then that would be a good place to start. And if you're successful in the beginning, that confidence will carry you through your career.
And we have some more advice from our panelists as well, if you'd like to hear.
A more general response to your question comes out of the apocryphal story of the tourist in New York who stops somebody on the street and says, excuse me, can you tell me how to get to Carnegie Hall? And he said, practice, baby, practice.
Danielle?
I think that Canada, just to Canada has this amazing opportunity to become, and I picture that in 25 years from now, to have the best domestic competition in the world because of our territories. If we go to this, Europe, countries are competing among each other because they just have to drive an hour here, an hour there, or two, and they're next door. But here in Canada, if we could create in snowboarding or women's hockey or ski cross or like the best competition in order to basically bring our best athlete to the world, will become better. And guess who? We might even attract other athletes from the age to, I don't know, 12 to 24 to come and compete in our school system or college system or university system. And I think this is what we have to look at, to have those domestic competition, Quebec versus Ontario, Ontario versus BC. And at the top, of course, you're going to have to travel the world, but this is where I picture Canada, to become one of the best domestic competition system in the world. And we have the ability to do that.
Did you have another question? Next question, I'll see if you have another.
Yeah, it kind of led me to my next question when you said how like your principal was like, because you had to miss like Mondays and Fridays. Once you're there, like once you're doing this semi-pro or professionally, how do you deal with like the, not necessarily failures, but I guess failures, like the last time when you were the 80th out of 100, or when you had to lose all your contracts, like those big things. How do you keep going past that? How does that like not stop you your career? I mean, I know there's will in it, but as a literal aspect of it, how does it not just stop your career there?
Well, I think it boils down to who you have around you that support you in the end. I remember specifically that race when I was in Solden, or Ischgl, Austria, and you know, the next day we were up on the glacier training again, and I just couldn't even believe it. You know, I could not believe it. I was like, maybe I'm not cut out to do this. You know, maybe 80th place is like a sign for me to like, you know, get back to the university or do, you know, what everybody else is going to do. And I called my dad, and I'm like, look, I think I want to come home. He wouldn't let me come home. He's like, no, you're not coming home. And at the time, you know, he was paying my bills for me, like, while I was in Europe to pay for all, I mean, traveling around the world in ski resorts is probably the most expensive way to go about competing in a sport. And so I think that was a big part of it, was having like a really good group of people that surround you. And I know it's hard sometimes because some of your friends are going to want to go like and do this on Friday night, and some of your friends are going to want to do something else. And you kind of have to like have a balance of life and decide for yourself. and make those tough decisions, like, no, I'm not going to, you know, go out and, you know, drink on Friday night or whatever everyone's doing, you know. And what I would rather do is actually go to the gym and inspire yourself that way. I know just from myself that I was thinking of my competitors in Austria that were working out all summer long, and I just wanted to make sure that I was in the gym half an hour longer than they were every day. And, you know, I made weightlifting and going to the gym like a big part of, you know, what I did and how it, you know, the feeling that you get after a workout is pretty hard to beat. So I think those are some good things to think about.
Thank you for your questions.
Thank you.
And we have another one from the audience.
I'm Michael Sedletsky. I have a question for Danielle. You said you were a coach for the women's hockey, right? So you didn't play the sport. So did that affect other people's opinions on your coaching, or did anyone doubt you because of that fact?
Not really, because most people don't know that. So I was coming in. Most people thought I had played a game, but not at that level. But then again, I played, but with my brother, like the old days, meaning like outdoors. But then when I grew up in the montagne, not too far away from here. And when we went to the ring, they said, well, they could play, but you cannot. And I continued to be involved in a sport, like learning the sport, working with great coaches, knocking on doors to say, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And a coach, at the end of the day, is there to make you do things, not to do it. And one of the perfect examples of that, the best example, I should say, is Wayne Gretzky, the great player, but he admitted that coaching was not exactly for him. So I think it's just a matter of like finding your path. I was passionate about sport, about hockey, and obviously coaching was the opportunity for me to follow that path.
All right, thank you.
And thank you for your question. Let's move on to... Oh. Yes, we have time for another question, of course.
I think it's a quick one. I found this very interesting, but I also found it striking that the definition of success that we've been using seems to be taking for granted that we're talking only about elite athletes. And I do realize that part of the topic is about that. But I was wondering if you could address the observation that 99% of Canadians who play sports will never compete for a medal, don't particularly want to compete for a medal, and they do it because it's fun. And I think the origin of sport probably didn't have to do necessarily with meddling or certainly not commercial endorsements, but because it's fun. And it's striking to me that we haven't talked much about those 99%. And I was wondering if you thought that it was something worth discussing at all, the possible... I realize that elite sports and people who go out, like I play Ultimate Frisbee twice a week, and I realize that aside from the fact that in both the case of our panelists and I, we're both bipeds who move through space, but aside from that, the sport has nothing to do with each other. But do you think that it's worth discussing what success means for Canadians when we come to allocating the resources of our government, whether it's worth discussing whether the ratio that we've currently got with on the podium versus community sports, whatever, whether that's a valid thing to talk about in this context?
Well, let's ask the question. Do you think that there should be more investment in recreational sports from the government, from other sources, for people to compete, not to compete, but just to have fun, or to exercise, to be healthier, to mentally and physically at that level?
Well, I think the societal success of an active population is enormous. It's at best partially understood by government. It's certainly not sexy, so there's not much willingness to commit to adequate performance of it. And we've allowed the educational system to become almost irrelevant in activity, physical activity today. So until that penny drops for government, that it's going to be a lot cheaper to maintain a society that's healthy than one that's sedentary, I don't see much movement.
And then I often said that, if we don't occupy our kids, they're occupying us as a police department. So, yes, it is very important, actually, to invest in sport and culture. And it's the human being of tomorrow. These are kids of the leadership of tomorrow. And it's unbelievable that we need to take care of it. There's this ad that I find very hard to look at. it's this man who, well, the same man, one is healthy and he's probably in his 80s, and one who is sick, and it's hard to watch, but the bottom line is to stay active. Being those great habits will obviously bring health and this society together. So no, we haven't talked about it today, but obviously this is the true value of sport, and we cannot lose that. This is the community sports.
That's one of the major reasons, actually, that we, myself and some of my teammates, started this Fast and Female organization that I mentioned in my opening presentation. We didn't like to see girls leaving sport before they could reach their elite potential, absolutely, but the big thing and the most rewarding thing is to see the impact that as an elite athlete, I can inspire girls just to stay active and to keep that active lifestyle, to stay interested in sport as a health as its health benefits, you know, leadership abilities and independence in just in general life skills, and I think that is the most rewarding thing for me, is to be able to see the impact that I can take what I learned as an elite athlete and give that back to the community in a way that, you know, motivates people just to strive for their own goals, whatever those are, you know, outside of elite sport. When I do a Fast and Female event, I'm not doing it to, you know, nurture the next generation of medal winners in cross-country skiing. I'm doing it because I want to see these people succeed in their lives, whatever that may be. And I think sport is an important component of just a general balanced lifestyle. Mm-hmm.
Simple question. It's, why are we going after medals? And I'm not asking in a way why would we not go for medals, but if we're going after medals and we have goals, for example, health or fitness in the population, or other goals, are we making sure that we leverage these medals into achieving our objectives?
Are you talking about elite sports or recreational or?
Well, the question, I don't know. Like, it's for us to decide what we want to achieve with these medals. Because we get the medals, but then after we have to leverage it in some kind of benefit for the population.
That actually leads me to our next question perfectly. you know, Canada's women's hockey team, of course, is one of the best in the world with a number of Olympic gold medals and world championships. There's kind of little left to prove. They've done it. They're just continuing as well, and they're now sharing their knowledge with other countries through our mentoring programs for coaches and players. We also see the Canadian Women's Hockey League sharing their knowledge, going out to women's hockey teams, getting them, and girls' hockey teams, getting more girls to play, whether recreationally or competitively. We have mentoring programs for coaches and players. How do we move forward after we have been successful at the highest level of sport? So what do we do after that? How do we inspire? How do we maintain after that?
Well, at the world level, yes, working with other countries actually to bring the awareness of women's hockey globally, and then to bring those countries to the next level. But it's also, like, I was talking to different national players who were, like, in the Edmonton region just this past weekend. And when they travel the Canada, actually, they go in small community and talk to kids and share their knowledge, share the fact that they've gone to university and they want to pursue a career. So I think that the medal, what it brings to our community, is to bring models. And what it's so beautiful to see is young kids looking up at athletes and say, well, you know what, I want to do something as well, no matter what it is. And I think that this is what's next to the sport, is on the international level, but also here domestically, to share a passion, no matter what it is, but to bring kids to take care of their own life.
I think for me, I remember the LA Games was probably the first Olympics that I remember. Munich too, but it was really young. But LA was the first time that I really immersed myself in watching the games, and I think after I realized that I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I just knew I wanted to have to train for it. And I was into everything that kids were into, you know, in the 80s. I was a skateboarder, I rode BMX, I was ski racing, snowboarding wasn't even in the spectrum. We weren't allowed to snowboard anywhere at the time. And I think that just the inspiration that I got from watching the athletes, even if I wasn't going to be a swimmer, or if I wasn't going to, you know, do the marathon running or whatever it was that I was watching, I just was impressed by the level of competition and the concept of all of the people in the whole wide world, and that's the best guy or girl in the whole world, on the whole planet. And I think that idea left an impression on me. And I found my way from that idea to where I am now. But, you know, everybody has a different way of realizing these goals and realizing exactly how they're going to process the ambition that they maybe can receive from those athletes.
I think there's a micro and a macro level involved here. At the micro level, in my case, I was a really nervous swimmer, trying to see whether I could be the best in the world, and that was my focus. The leveraging is done by somebody else. The leveraging is done by the community as a whole, saying, "Oh, well, look, we can do this. Maybe we should get in the pool or get on the track and see whether somebody else can do it as well." But I think to turn your competing athlete into an ambassador or sport policy person is not a good connection at the time. Later on, you can see in retrospect what it may have accomplished, but not at the time.
But once we get there, how does Canada do in terms of dealing with its success? Do we use it the right way? Do we put it in the right place?
I think we're starting to. I mean, the Canadian Olympic Committee has done kind of a 180 in terms of not just being a travel agent every 2 years for one of the games, and is now actively promoting on a national and a local basis the success of the Olympians, getting them involved in community efforts and schools and all that sort of stuff. So I think there's a potential to be quite effective in leveraging from the sports side, and that'll be matched, you hope, from the public and private sectors.
Comment a little bit about how the athletes feel after they've gone through the Olympic machine and maybe you've medaled or not with regards to the Vancouver Games. Before, so for me it was Nagano, and then the next Olympics was Salt Lake City. And for one reason or another, I'm not going to get into it, I wasn't competing in Salt Lake City, but I was able to make it down there and to be a part of it as a spectator. And the Olympic organizing committee from Salt Lake City gave me full credentials and basically a free pass to any of the events and special events that were held afterwards and stuff. And with regards to the Vancouver Games, I was actually like no credentials, no tickets to go to see any events, even the snowboard events. I bought tickets to go see the snowboard events, and then there's bad weather canceled it. But I think psychologically, I wasn't very happy about being a part of a fake family in my eyes. Like, I would have appreciated having a full pass for all of my family and my friends to go and be a part of the Vancouver Games and to be a spectator. So I think there's a lot of room there
to recognize,
to improve how the athletes are perceived and how the athletes will perceive their experience afterwards.
All right, we have a question.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but I'd be interested in what you think about the potential in Canada for elite women's team sports, the possibility of having a professional career as a female athlete. The example in the U.S. is kind of discouraging, or at least how they've interpreted it. They have the WNBA, and that has been kind of understood in the U.S. as, well, you know, the market rules. It hasn't succeeded in market terms, and what they found is that women, big fans of basketball, including women, are more likely to watch the men. So there isn't a built-in, but you could also argue they chose the worst possible sport to start a professional league. So that's how it's been played in the U.S., kind of a discouraging example of a professional league for women's team sports. I'm wondering, and Danielle, you touched on this a little bit, what you think the chances are from a Canadian perspective or with a Canadian sports model, should we, have we given up on professional team sports for women? And if not, then how would we go about that?
That's a good question, actually, because then again, when I look at the U.S. model, we go to see football games at the high school level, and I mean, it's packed. Basketball, women's basketball, same thing. And then it's part of like going to see team sport in the States, both women and men. As here, we don't really have that. Like I'm directing the university women's hockey, team at the University of Montreal, actually, and it's been on for 3 years. And it's the first time that a university will put a female team and not a men's team. So we're the only university, so which is a good sign. But it depends on who we play. When there's a game between Montreal and McGill, there's one next Friday, by the way, and that would be nice if the ring would be back. And McGill is the best team in Canada for many years. I mean, this is the number one team, and we have maybe 300 people watching our game. But then again, at the Winter Olympic Games, there are 12, 13 million Canadians watch the women's game. But then again, there's a big gap. And is it going to be professional? Is it going to go professional? It's a long way to go. Why? Because it's not part of our culture to just go and see team sport in this country. And then again, women's hockey, if we compare ourselves often to the basketball women's American professional team, but there's so much more many basketball, female basketball player in the States than there is hockey player in this country. So it's a question of, should we go professional? That's the question we have right now. Should we go and have like four teams in this country competing in order to create this system, like this domestic system that I talked about, and then draw people coming in, and then maybe by itself it's gonna become professional. And it's a big challenge. Short track, speed skating, same thing. At the Olympics, it was packed. People are just going to see those. We just have a World Cup, and there was maybe 1,000 people in the stands. So it's part of our culture that we watch the Olympics, World Championship. The Women's World Championship is going to be in Ottawa at the beginning of April. I'm sure it's going to be packed. But then again, we go through this, but it's not part of our culture. But so by creating this domestic competition, I think we're going to get there. I think it has to go through there.
We do have a professional women's hockey league, the Canadian Women's Hockey League, of course, and the Montreal Stars are just repeated on their Clarkson Cup win at the last season. But I'm wondering if that is, and we don't have a lot of time, I'm sorry. I'm wondering how we use that as a model. What does something like the Canadian Women's Hockey League have to do to be able to sustain itself? Because right now they are self-governed, they fight for funding all the time. Is it a change in culture? What is it that needs to change for that to be a really good feeder system and development system for hockey?
Well, if we look at the path, we have high school, university, college, university, and then if we say if we want to maintain our gold medal or being the first on the podium, we need to create space or a place for those players to play. Like when you graduated from university, what do you do in team sports? So we need to create those structure. And if that structure has to be put in place with the private and federal government in order to have our carded athlete, for example, to play in those system, well, so be it. And right now we're working with other countries, those countries could bring those players to play here in Canada to create what they used to be the national team on the men's side. But then again, it's not only women's hockey. There's other sports that are struggling doing that. So we need to say, okay, the Olympic path is that rowing, for example, the athlete's going to row till the age of 35. So what do we do for these athletes to maintain those athletes in a system like that? And we really need to look at it because, yes, we want to be creating medalists or Olympian, but then again, they graduate from high school, not high school, but university at the age of 24. So we need to create those sport center and have our best playing amongst their best and obviously create those team. Water polo is the same thing. Right now, water polo, they're fourth or fifth in the world. And they, in order to go to the Olympics, they have to beat the States. We're number one or number three. And there's more water polo player in the states of Florida. There's water polo player in Canada. So we're pretty good. But we need to create this domestic, again, system and maintain them in those centers in order to go to the next level. And it's not going to be professional, most probably.
Very short, yes.
You were thinking that that this national competitive environment of the provinces against one another, that would come out of the university system then. It wouldn't be, the goal wouldn't be a professional. It would be that that would come out of more attendance and more publicity and from the university level on the women's side.
The university level is part of the pathway because obviously there's an age limit there, there's eligibility there. But what do we do with a Caroline Ouellette, for example, a Kim St-Pierre, a Charlene Labonté, basically need a place to play in order to be on the national team. So if we were creating a 14 leagues across the country, being helped by, obviously, podium to create those this domestic domestic competition that I'm talking about, and redirecting the money to say, okay, these players need a place to play, so obviously we could create that internally to have other countries coming in and say, we're going to send you, and became the best league in the world. But right now we're trying to do it only in Canada, and we basically telling the best athlete to say, take care of your own development. The Montreal Star is being ran by Caroline Ouellette. She's still on the national team. She's trying to get sponsors, trying to get people that, I mean, we cannot ask that to our female hockey player to take care of a team and try to compete on the national level at the same time.
You should go to a game too, it's really fun.
Sorry.
One of the big problems in all of this is the shape of our country. You know, we're 10,000 kilometers long and 500 kilometers deep, and so the cost structure is just overpowering, and we've got, the problem is we've got good athletes spread all across that band, and getting them together, we have a few centers, but it's a very expensive proposition. And so I would think it would mitigate against a commercially viable league.
Thank you very much to our panel. Of course, I think we've raised a lot more questions after this, but that's great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dick Pound, Ross Rabbiati, Daniela Sauvageau, Madeline Williams. I hope you had a great time. Thank you. And here's Will Straw, the director of the conference.
Thank you so much, Sadhana. Thank you all. That was fantastic. I now invite you to join us for lunch. The lunch is in the Pierre de Coubertin room, which is just basically right outside. Reviens à 2h moins 5, 2h pile pour la prochaine session.